Have you ever felt you couldn't make choices at work without repercussions? Saying no to too much work? Picking your next role in the organization that might be great for you, but not so great for your boss? And you just don't feel like you can do that. Or as leaders, do we know how to create the culture that allows agency and choice for employees? Psychologist Dr. Lauren Appio is all over that today. She shares how we can create the consent culture we all want and deserve, but don't always know what that looks like or how to start. Hold on. Hello, I'm Russell Lolliker, host of the Relationships at Work podcast, the guide for emerging leaders to improve the employee experience. I'm a communications nerd with a couple of decades of experience and a heap of curiosity on how we can make the workplace better. So I'm learning on this show. And thank you for joining me to learn as well. And I am super excited to share today that Dr. Lauren Appio is here, and she's got quite a bit to say. And I think I rhymed today with say, but keep moving. Move on. We're moving on. What is a consent culture? What does it look like in the hiring process or through the employee journey? What even is it? What are the areas we as leaders need to focus on to build that culture of agency and choice? And how do some leaders get it so very wrong? Not you, though. You've got Dr. Appio to hear from. And on the podcast today, it's Dr. Lauren Appio. And here is why she is awesome. She's an executive coach, speaker, and licensed psychologist providing psychotherapy, career coaching, and organizational consulting for more than a decade. Her thoughts and work have been featured in Huffington Post, New York Magazine, BuzzFeed, Oprah Magazine. I'm going to run out of breath saying things. I knew I had to chat with her as her Instagram could literally be our shared motto, which is let's make work less shitty for each other. Hello, Lauren.
Hi, Russell. How you doing today?
I'm very good. I have to start off all things. What's your best or worst employee experience, Lauren?
So my best employee experience was, I'm a psychologist, as you mentioned. I did my training out in California in a college counseling center, and I loved, and I'm from New Jersey, did my training in New York, and so I loved sort of getting to know the like regional cultural differences. And one of the things that I really, really enjoyed was whenever there were like milestones for people, either people were retiring or having, you know, a baby or things, you know, we would take time out of the day and have a little party, and people would write songs, you know, based on, you know, like Country Roads or other, you know, famous songs. They would write songs for people and sing them playing instruments. And I just thought it was so sweet and fun and completely unlike anything that would have happened in my like training sites, you know, in Manhattan. And so I really enjoyed that and found that to be, you know, really nice. And it would happen during the workday. So it wasn't like people were expected to stay after or anything like that. So it was fun. My worst work experience was pretty much what motivated me to start my private practice and do a lot of the work that I do on my Instagram, which was in a college counseling center, you know, after I had graduated. It was deeply understaffed, and really, I mean, we were functioning almost like a psych ER, where we were, you know, really trying to support students through a myriad of psychological crises without the resources to do so. And when we were burnt out and having wild caseloads and, you know, really feeling scared about our capacity to really support our students, you know, we were getting messages from the administration like, well, if you cared about the students, you would make it work. And I just found that to be so deeply insulting. And so I felt so completely like, you have no idea who I am if you're saying that to me and to us. And so that's when I started making my exit plan of, I can't do this. I can't not only feel so completely burnt out and scared going to work, but to then also feel so fundamentally disrespected as an employee and as a, you know, as a person. So that was the worst, and was really the catalyst for a lot of the work that I do now.
how polar opposite can you get? Literally, Kumbaya literally is being sung at work.
Yes. I know. And of course, you know, that workplace wasn't perfect either. But I do think one of the things that I really valued about that other workplace is that there was a real sort of intentional focus on, for example, naming regional cultural difference. One of the things that my supervisor said to me when I first started, because I was noticing these things and very worried that I would be perceived as rude or, you know, something. And she was like, well, you know, rudeness and feeling that way, those are often related to cultural differences. And I think, you know, if you're feeling that way, let's talk about it. And there was just a real openness to kind of just discussing difference and individual differences. And so I really loved that and really appreciated that about them.
That plays nicely into our topic today, which is consent culture.
Yes.
And I'm a big person when it comes to defining things, because I think we throw around terms far too often that we never actually define or even define it as per that particular organization.
Yes.
So we kind of have I mean, we're not talking about it as per an organization, but I am curious how you would define consent culture.
So, I mean, that is a big question. And I think it starts with this idea that essentially most of us don't consent to work. Most of us have to work. We have to work to pay our bills. If we stopped working, you know, and I know, and I'm talking to you, you're in Canada.
Yes, I am. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm in the US. And so our, you know, our support systems are a bit different between our two countries, but overall, right, people, you know, there's no guaranteed income. There's no, you know, there's no way for people to pay their bills. In the US, our health insurance is tied to our employment for most working people. And so we have to, right? Most of us don't have a choice, and we don't even think about having a choice of do I want to work and earn money for a living? Do I want to make other contributions to my community? And so starting from that premise that the system of employment in a capitalist society and world is inherently coercive, I like to think about consent culture at work as being really, really intentional about paying attention to power differences, paying attention to the ways that we have and use our authority and influence with each other, and really maximizing people's ability to truly have choice, to truly be able to say yes or no to the work that they do, the way that they engage with their work, the amount of work that they take on, and the relationships that they have with their colleagues.
So why is this so important? Because you're going to have people listening to this going, yeah, I pay you to do a thing, you do a thing. Why is this to be more than that?
Yeah. And so there are plenty of people who make a great business case for things like psychological safety at work. And, you know, I'm much more in the business of, I think when we don't pay attention to these dynamics, we run the risk of really creating or exacerbating mental health difficulties among ourselves and our colleagues. I think you can't go on the internet without seeing news stories about rampant burnout, about increasing, you know, just all kinds of negative health outcomes for people. There are stories about workers quiet quitting. There's always like a new term about how people are trying to manage their relationship to work. And so, you know, that old idea of like, I pay you to do a job, do it or leave. If you don't care about the people who work with you and for you, you know, I don't know how to make you do that. But I think, you know, we as a society have a vested interest in having, you know, healthy people and people who can show up and do their work well and also have a life outside of work and, you know, to have that kind of experience together as a society just benefits all of us. So I'm one of those people that's like, you know, I hate making the business case for this because it's sort of just the right thing to do, but it is effective, right? We see that psychological safety improves creativity on teams, trust. There are productivity outcomes associated with it, because when you feel safe, you're freed up. When you don't feel safe, you're scared. That's not great for, you know, creative thinking, motivation. You know, fear and shame are not great motivators, despite what people may think. And so, you know, there are a lot of just wide-ranging benefits to thinking about how we can have more of a consent culture in our workplaces.
So what does that look like for a first impression? I know we're sort of being very high level with what an organization should sort of best practices-ish, but it's that first impression for a new employee walking into a new organization, a new culture. How do they know, as part of the onboarding process, even the hiring process, that they're entering into a consent culture?
So, I mean, I think it does start from the very first interaction that a potential employee has. I mean, Russell, I have to give you a lot of credit, because I appreciated, you know, from the very beginning of our interactions, I think that you did a lot of things to demonstrate that you were being intentionally thoughtful about any potential questions or concerns that I might have about us, you know, having this conversation, working together. You know, there's a real proactive sense of, like we were just talking about earlier, like, you can curse on this podcast, and this is what you can expect. These are the questions that I ask, you know, really providing people with information to put them at ease. You know, I'm a big fan of, in the interview process, you're rooting for your candidates. You're not trying to trip them up. So anything from really making sure people have a clear sense of where they're supposed to be at what time and how they can get there and how they can troubleshoot if they're having, you know, difficulties finding where they're supposed to be, who they can contact, really doing a lot to make sure that, you know, from a communication standpoint, you're letting people know the full range of their options. And then also how you respond to people when, especially when things go wrong, right? If you have somebody who walks into an interview and they're late because of something, you know, are you sort of punishing them for that? Or are you demonstrating some understanding, really kind of with the hope of, you know, we're going to get this back on track and, you know, let's get comfortable and let's talk. So you're not being punitive when things are going wrong. You know, those are some of the initial things that I encourage people to look at of, you know, do you feel like you have a sense, a clear sense of your options, a clear sense of how things are expected to go and what happens if things go wrong?
One of the things that frustrates me the most is those that look at time less compassionately, especially in the hiring process, because they'll either go, we want the best candidates and give you the questions 15 minutes before the interview.
Yes.
Or they give you a written assignment with 2 days to do it during a work day where you don't have the mental capacity to do it after work because you're burned out from 8, 9, 10 hours of work of a job you're trying to get out of.
Yes. There's such a clear lack of empathy or understanding for what the applicants are going through in order to participate in the interview. And also, I mean, just real poor decision-making and judgment around, like, how does that actually show you who is, quote, the best person for the job? Which is sort of like a bullshit thing anyway, because there are going to be many great people for this particular role who would approach the role in any number of wonderful ways. And so, you know, like, I agree with you. I'm a big fan of, like, give people some of the interview questions in advance. Give people the interview questions that you're really interested in advance. This is just good across the board. It's good for, you know, candidates who maybe are multilingual, neurodivergent candidates. It's good across the board. So yes, I agree 100% of, like, why are we burdening people? We're already hazing people into the organization. That's not a great thing.
It's a big difference between wanting employees to thrive versus wanting them to survive.
Exactly.
Ooh, that's a bumper sticker. Damn,
that was good. Yes, it is. Put that on a t-shirt, Russell. I mean, it's exactly it. And you know, right? I think the other thing that I think about when it comes to consent culture that is really challenging in its implementation is that it really requires a lot of ideological shifts for many of us in what we expect about work in general. like people expect to be hazed in an interview. You know, people expect that you're going to go in and get grilled, or that you have to jump through hoops and, you know, have 7 rounds of an interview or something ridiculous in order to get this very prized, you know, opportunity. And for us to reconsider, like, why do we do that? Who does that serve? How does that actually get you any information? You know, are we just doing this because of some outdated, like, control and command kinds of ideas that we have about what it means to engage in a work relationship? You know, I just think we can really do it differently, but it does require fundamentally questioning our assumptions about what workplaces and career mean.
When we first started having the conversation of setting up this conversation, mm-hmm. you brought up the idea of consent culture being closely connected with trauma-informed workplaces. What yeah. does that mean when you mean trauma-informed?
So I think when a lot of people say trauma-informed workplaces, they're talking about how the employees of a workplace, often teachers, counselors, other nonprofit workers, people often in sort of caregiving, healthcare, or helping professions, how we can be trauma informed for the people we serve, how we can understand the symptoms, the behaviors of people who are experiencing PTSD, complex trauma, or other mental health issues, that we're aware of the frequency with which traumatic events happen for people across the board, everything from, you know, childhood abuse to experiences with racism and poverty and oppression to, you know, combat experiences in car accidents, to be aware of the fact that there are so many things that happen that can impact people's mental health and their capacity and functioning over the lifespan. And to really be considerate about how the operations and the policies and practices of our organization should not replicate traumatizing sorts of experiences. So we want to really emphasize agency and choice for the people that we serve as they connect with us and move through our organization. What people often find is that the employees of said organization, you know, they may be asked to be trauma-informed for the people that they serve, but then they are not treated as employees with that same trauma-informed lens. And so employees also have experiences of trauma or other mental health difficulties that can impact the range of their capacity and functioning over the course of their time in the organization. They also really need to experience agency and choice and empowerment in relationship to their work. And so many of those considerations are not made, right? How many of us have been in workplaces where we've been told that we have to do things we're not comfortable with or take on more work than we're comfortable with and really feel powerless about how to do that, because, you know, we either do it or we potentially risk getting fired or we don't get promoted, that there are all of these risks. And, you know, for anybody, that's a frustrating experience. But if you also have a real history of disempowering experiences, it can be, you know, extremely, extremely, you know, people demonize the word triggering, but in this case, really, it can be very much eliciting of serious panic and, you know, other symptoms that make it really, really hard to potentially function at work or at home, or you're functioning, but it's burning you out and really, really affecting you negatively. And so, you know, my hope and one of the messages I have is, you know, if your organization cares about making a difference out in the world, start at home. Whatever difference you're trying to make out in the world, how can you make that difference for the people that you employ? You know, do your employees have that sense of empowerment? Do they feel valued and respected? Do they feel like they have choice and option? You know, do they feel like they can say yes to things or no to things without consequence? How do you handle when people say no to things that have to get done? You know, what are the processes you have as an organization to address that, and being really intentional about those kinds of things?
I want to get into the mindset tactic shift when it comes to trying to make your organization a consent culture, because there's a lot of emerging leaders that, especially ones that look at that, listen to this podcast, who are, we can do better. We know we can do better. I don't want to do what the old person at the top has done before. So how do we build a consent culture? I love this post on Instagram where you kind of broke it down into four areas. And I want to get that granular because I think it's important to attack it from those four areas. So it was individual work, interpersonal work, institutional practices, and coercive ideologies and norms. So can you sort of walk me through that?
Yeah. So that's, it's a framework called the four I's that I did not make up, but that seems to be, you know, if anyone has a citation for that, let us know. It's one of those things that seems to be kind of like called different names in different industries, but looking at the issue across these different domains helps us to be really, just really thorough. So the individual domain is looking at, you know, what can I do as a person? What's the internal work that I can do as a person towards building a consent culture? And so what that looks like for leaders is to, with, you know, with peers, with a therapist, with coach, take some inventory of your own history of empowerment or disempowerment. What has it been like for you in your life to say no to things? Have you had experiences where you weren't allowed to say no? How have you been able to say no at work? And, you know, as I write in that post, if you've never even considered saying no, that might be a no. It might mean that you really haven't felt like you can say no to things, or you know, really, really consider what is in your best interest or what is in your bandwidth that maybe you really felt compelled to meet the needs or expectations of the people that you've worked for. But looking at this across all different domains in your family life, in your community, in school, etc. The other internal work is really getting a sense of your own coercion and control patterns. You know, what is it that you do when you are trying to get somebody to do something you want them to do? What do you do when you want to change somebody's mind? What happens inside of you when someone tells you no, or when someone is doing something you don't want them to do? And I say in that post too, coercion and control is a spectrum. I think, you know, many of your listeners are probably not, you know, slamming people up against walls, but micromanaging, for example, is a control tactic, right? It's a way of trying to get people to behave in a way that you want them to behave, and not really trusting them to, you know, engage in the behaviors that they might choose, and then working with them if there are consequences to that behavior, etc. So really getting a sense of how that plays out for you. What are the feelings that come up? What are the thoughts? And then what are, you know, the behaviors or the urges that you have in those moments? And then the other internal work is to really, really build your stress management and self-soothing skills. So that when you have those experiences, when you have the urge to jump in and really, you know, potentially push somebody to do something you want them to do, or, you know, you keep coming back and like after someone has said no, or I don't have the bandwidth for that, and you keep coming back over and over again and trying to kind of push them into it, that you can kind of soothe your own reactivity or your own sort of urgency that you have in that moment, and be able to think a little bit more collaboratively or cooperatively about the issue at hand. The other important thing about being able to manage your own reactivity is that if your colleagues are afraid of you, if they're afraid of upsetting you, if they're afraid of making you angry, if they're afraid that you're going to be so stressed out that you're going to crumble, that will also in its own way encourage them to maybe not say no as often to you, or to overwork on your behalf. And so it's important to be able to kind of have the emotional resources and get the support you need in order to do that so that people, you know, feel safe around you. So that's just one domain as I take a breath to think about the next ones. So there's a lot of internal work that can happen. But then as we move on to the next domain, the interpersonal domain, of course, that is what can we do in our relationships with each other to work towards a consent culture. For leaders, I often encourage them, you know, as they're doing this internal work, to anticipate times during the year or interactions where that people may feel a little bit more pressure or stress, which I think in those situations, there is more risk for coercion or potentially abuses of power when, you know, people were approaching a deadline or, you know, it's a busy time of year. And so kind of being able to bring up in those times like, hey, you know, we're approaching this deadline, tensions are high. Let's try to remember, you know, how we want to treat each other during, you know, this time. If you're starting to feel pressured by me and my expectations, or, you know, if I see that happening, we want to address it because ultimately, like, yes, we're going to meet this deadline, but how we treat each other is just as important as how we get there. If you are, as a leader, going through some kind of personal loss, or there's, you know, on your team, right, somebody might be avoiding you a little bit because they haven't gotten a report to you or something. Instead of just sort of letting that be, you intentionally kind of proactively have a conversation with that person and say, you know, I know you're working on this report. And I want you to know that even while this is outstanding, I'm still here to support you, or I'm still here to, you know, if you need additional resources, so that they don't feel like they have to do this quid pro quo thing where they can only ask for something of you if they get the thing done that you need from them. Or, you know, they're not trying to overwork for you because they want to compensate for the fact that you're going through this like personal stress that you have. And so there's really the work of doing the internal work and then being able as a leader to kind of name and notice potential dynamics that could create, you know, the risk of coercion. Other big things are, you know, as a leader, you've got to address and take seriously reports of sexual harassment, microaggressions, bias and discrimination. These are all, of course, abuses of power and things that contribute to a lack of safety at work. And I think they're often complex and still really need to be dealt with consistently, because obviously leadership comes from the top on this. If leaders aren't doing that, then these things don't really get dealt with. But I think the other things are what I said that you've done here in our relationship in doing this podcast is letting people know about their options up front. I know that the statement like, hey, I need this, it's okay if you can't do that, or it's okay if not, kind of gets also vilified as this like overly deferential thing. I actually really like it. I like if you can remind people that they have an out, remind people that they have multiple options in how they respond to requests. Those kinds of things are sort of the interpersonal aspects that I would encourage leaders to focus on.
You know that we talk about this stuff, but the bad leaders are the ones that are never listening to this podcast. They're the ones that aren't going to the workshops where they actually need to learn these things.
I know.
So how are they getting this wrong, Lauren?
Oh my gosh. Russell, I have like about 18 thoughts that are going through my mind. So they're getting this wrong, I think, in some ways, which kind of brings us to like one of the other four I's, the ideological level, is that they have beliefs, these taken for granted truths that we kind of all inherit in our, you know, cultural conditioning, that they really just expect to have power over people, right? Like some managers think that being a manager means that you have a right to have power over the people that you that report to you. You know, that it makes you a tyrant. What you say goes. That's a cultural inheritance of domination and command and control culture that will affect how they experience people who make mistakes, who have changes in their capacity or bandwidth, who are reporting things like discrimination or sexual harassment. They're seeing sort of everything through this lens of domination, of inferiority and superiority, which makes it hard for them to recognize that everybody has rights, including the people who report to them.
So you're in an organization and you're noticing this is not a consent culture. This is not pretty much the example you gave of a bad employee experience.
Yeah.
If you don't feel like that you have influence from a leadership top-down environment, how do you ask for a consent culture within the organization you work?
So it's a hard question because I don't want to say that people can't have power or influence in those situations. But I'm also really reluctant to encourage people to care more about an issue than the leaders do themselves, because I do worry about people taking on sort of like a Sisyphean battle here of having to try to push something through or try to organize around something that they don't have a lot of support for. But I do think that the biggest thing is to build a network of support of other colleagues who may feel the same way. Because that's always going to be your best bet, is to organize within the workplace, to consolidate the power that you have with each other and say, you know, these are the things we're noticing that are not working here. And we really want to emphasize practices and policies in this organization that give people more autonomy, that give people more of a sense of choice, that create systems that kind of recognize people's humanness. And so that means that if one person needs to tap out, what happens next to other people? How do we redistribute work, you know, in an equitable way, in a way that is manageable and sustainable? How do we design workflows to be more sustainable? And I think your best bet is to do it together.
Conversations around workplace culture has certainly, thankfully, finally freaking started being a little bit more at the forefront. I mean, I literally started this podcast a year and a half ago because nobody was talking about it. I'm like, well, fuck it. I'll jump in the arena. So, but thankfully, you know, it's getting there. But looking at institutional practices is one of those eyes you brought up earlier.
Yeah.
Can we be hopeful at all, Lauren, here? Like, are we getting to a place, we've got generations basically saying they don't want to put up with crap that you and I put up with? Should we be looking at a bright future, or do we still have a long road ahead of us for this consent?
I think there's always good reason to be hopeful. I do think that, you know, the more people aren't putting up with the same shit that we have all put up with for generations, that it's going to force workplaces to change, and we're seeing that. I think we are up against a lot of really big, you know, we're up against capitalism, we're up against colonialism, we're up against all of these major, major forces that really perpetuate that sort of domination, command and control culture. But I do think that there are a lot of very well-intentioned people. I think there are a lot of leaders who are trying to do this differently. And there are ways to do it better. There are absolutely ways to do it better, to have really clear policies and practices in place, to be responsive to feedback, to be a humble leader. You know, there are ways to pay people really well so that you, like, you know, people are, that's what people are motivated by. And so you're paying people well, you're engaging them. You know, there are good ways that we can do this to make it better, even in a flawed system. But it's going to require a lot of us doing it together. And I'm excited by things like seeing, you know, Amazon workers unionize. I mean, there is room to be hopeful, and there is a long way to go.
I had an amazing conversation recently with a leader where she was self-described old school, where she says she was really struggling with remote work and flexible work because in her world, it's always been, if I can't see you, I can't build a relationship or build a culture or bounce off of a culture with you unless we're all physically in the same space. However, she had her own daughter who's like, I never want to go into work ever. Why would I need to go into work? I can do my work from anywhere in the world. So she was identifying first that she knew she was old school, but also identifying that she needed to learn and that maybe the world isn't so black and white from what she was taught. So though she wasn't at a tipping point yet, she certainly was open to the conversation and understanding she might not have all the answers. So I big smile on my face. Like, I was thrilled that conversation even happens, and hope it happens more often. In your work, have you enjoyed those light bulb moments where you can see organizations shift a little bit more to that consent culture in real life?
Yeah. And I mean, everything from as simple as there was an organization I worked with that was, I don't want to give too much information, but it was, you know, it was a little bit more of like a startup culture. And so things were like seemingly super flexible, right? You know, the unlimited PTO, you know, and they didn't have a specific parental leave policy because they were basically like, oh, you know, people can take whatever time they need, or like, we'll figure that out as we get to it. And, you know, from their perspective, that created the most flexibility and was sort of the best course of action. But when really what that would potentially mean is, you know, anybody who is potentially applying for that role will see that there's no parental leave policy and be like, oh, no way. Like, I'm not doing that. Or it requires potentially a pregnant person or people within the organization to have to advocate for themselves around what they're going to need, which means that they could be worrying about risking discrimination, all kinds of things. And so, you know, one of the things that we talked about was actually when you can have really clear, generous policies, that creates more safety for people. They know what to expect. If they need more or less, or whatever the case might be, then, you know, that's part of building the culture around, you know, people feeling like they can speak up without retaliation or discrimination. That's that piece. But having the really specific, generous policies is really where you need to start. And seeing them like very quickly adopt, you know, the parental leave policy that was super inclusive of birthing parents, adoptive parents, foster parents, you know, parents of all genders, you know, they were able to kind of add more structure that's still connected with their values. And I was just like, this is a beautiful thing to witness. And so I think people really, a lot of people really want to do this, but it either feels too overwhelming or they feel like it's not possible. And it really just requires holding the time, space, energy, and resources to really thinking through it in a very practical way, at least from an institutional policy perspective. And there are plenty of people who are doing this work. There are plenty of amazing, you know, consultants, researchers, scholars, intellectuals who, you know, have great ideas around this. And it's really just a matter of taking the time to implement it.
I have to wrap it up with the most important question I ask. It's not really, but it's a nice capper for the day. What's one simple action, Lauren, that people can do right now to improve their relationships at work?
So part of me was dreading this question a little bit because you know, I have like 18 things of varying levels of complexity that I could share, but I figured I would let it be a game time decision. And I think from our conversation today, what I would really encourage, especially leaders, but anyone in the workplace, is when you are, you know, interacting with your colleagues, to kind of have this question in the back of your mind of, you know, am I aware of the power, influence, or authority I have with this person? And am I engaging ethically with that in mind? Am I trying to change their mind? Am I trying to make them do something different? Or am I trying to have a conversation collaboratively about a solution that will meet both of our needs?
That's Lauren Appio. She's an executive coach, speaker, licensed psychologist, trying to help us all create a consent culture, consent culture, and probably help me speak better, and, you know, make work less shitty for each other. Thanks so much, Lauren.
Yes. Russell, thank you so much for having me. I could talk with you about this all day.
And that'll do it for another episode of Relationships at Work, the Employee Experience and Workplace Culture podcast. I'm Russell Lawlacher. Thanks so much for being here. Thanks for listening. If you have a moment to spare, a piece of time, if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to go over to the ratings and review section on Spotify or Apple or wherever you get your podcasts and leave one of those rating or reviews and, you know, share what you learned and how much you enjoyed the podcast. It's great. It always helps the algorithm on those directories of where you get your podcasts. So it gets a little bit more attention and it'll really help the show out. So I'd appreciate if you could do that. Please. Pretty please. Thanks. Have a great day.